In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Let's all go to the lobby.
Yeah, it's Let's time to talk movies. All right, lobby. We do it every Monday afternoon Let's with Alan Adams of The Main Edge. And look, there he is on our telephone right now. Hello, Alan.
I am here. It's me.
And I'm so glad. How was your weekend?
Oh, it was pretty good. It's pretty good. How was yours?
It was very good, as weekends go, because I spent a lot of it reading the book you recommended last week by Claire McNear, Answers in the Form of a Question. And I've not been on the show like you, but as a longtime fan, man, I love it. What a great read.
And that's such a good book, man. As someone who has gone through the process, I really do, and I mentioned this in my review, but like, I really do feel like it is as accurate a portrayal of the process from soup to nuts, like test to being on the show, that I've ever seen. So it's really wonderful that she was able to put something like that together, because, you know, the fans out there, it's a nice peek behind the curtain.
Yeah, and it was good to see another friend of Downtown, Ted Berg, mentioned in there after his appearance in 2019.
Yep. That's one of the great things about it. Like, she spoke to something like 100 former contestants. And, you know, I mean, the big names, obviously, but, you know, then plenty of people that, were on the show 20 years ago in the days before social media, or, you know, people like myself who, one and done. Like, it really does a great job of capturing sort of the range of experiences that contestants have.
And now I have to say, I'm a little obsessed with the J Archive.
Oh man, yeah. Like, you could really, that's a rabbit hole you can lose some time in. whether it's looking at old games or discovering things like, and we talked about this last week, but discovering things like Coriat scores and those sorts of deals. It's like it's remarkable how robust a sort of new data sort of scene has arisen around the show. It just goes to show you that the real greats transcend generations, and you can always find different ways to enjoy the same thing.
Yeah, that's for sure. All right, what'd you see for movies this weekend?
Oh man, I got four.
Whoa.
I got four in the queue here. So it's an interesting sort of very wide array of different types of things. We've got a Netflix holiday movie. We've got an indie comedy, we've got a domestic drama, and we've got a French language ode to the origins of electronic music. So where would you like to start?
Let's start with the French, of course.
Okay, so it's a film called Le Choc du Futur, translation, The Shock of the Future. It's one of those movies, like, there's something great about being surprised by a movie, I don't have the opportunity to do that as much as I used to, simply because, just by the nature of the gig, like, you're sort of paying closer attention to the trappings of the cinematic world. So there are a lot of movies that that may have flown under the radar for various reasons that, you know, you kind of catch, but still a few will occasionally manage to sneak through. And I had never heard of this movie before I sort of crossed paths with it, and I had never heard of Mark Collin. He's a French musician who basically makes his writing and directing feature debut with this movie. But, a publicist reached out. It was an official selection at South by Southwest and got a fair amount of positive attention there. So I figured I'd give it a shot. But I had no idea what I was getting into. And the basic gist is it's a young woman played by Alma Jodorowsky, who's living in late 1970s Paris. Basically coming to terms with the looming changes in the music world. That's kind of it. Like, it's a movie that's not really about anything. There's not a lot of story to be had here. It's very much a day in the life sort of thing. Jodorowsky plays a young woman named Anna. She's living and working in Paris in 1978. She's moved into the apartment of a friend, a musician friend who's out of town, and he is an electronic musician. And so it's like in his apartment, just this giant wall of old school, like electronic, like music tech, like lots of like dials and buttons and flashing knobs and all that stuff. Like, and so this woman is basically convinced that the future of music is in electronic music. And so we basically spend the day with her. Like, we never really leave the apartment. Some people come and go. Like, there's a music producer who hired her to write a TV jingle that she's absolutely not going to write. There's a gear buddy of the dude whose apartment it is who comes by with a new piece of equipment that's like a beatbox that kind of is a game changer for what Anna hopes to do. You got the aging hipster who comes by with a handful of records for Anna to listen to. And then there's a singer who turns up for a canceled recording session, but then winds up lending her talents to the track that Anna is currently working on. And this all culminates, you know, for a given value of culminates, in a sort of listening party that takes place that evening, where she plays a bunch of records and then unveils her own new track to try and impress a record executive who has shown up. And it's an effort that may or may not prove to be as fruitful as she hopes. And that's kind of it. But it's very much a love letter to the early days of electronic music, like sort of an embrace of the old school beginnings that laid the foundation for, frankly, a lot of the popular music that we listen to today. It also celebrates some of the pioneering women who battled the prejudices of it was dominated by males then, still dominated by males, music industry. To become sort of the early evangelists for the possibilities of electronic music. It's a very small, intimate movie. It's aesthetically, it's great. They do a wonderful job of sort of evoking that late 70s vibe through color saturation and the tonal visuals that they choose. And I got to say, like, the music's pretty awesome. Like, it's wonderful, like, sort of selection of, you know, stuff like from real old school electronic artists like Throbbing Gristle and Human League and that sort of music, along with some stuff produced original stuff produced for the film. And I will say specifically, any gear fetishists out there, like fans of that sort of old school tech, they're gonna love this movie. Like, I'm not intimately familiar with the particulars, but I know enough to know that people who do have that intimate familiarity will be thrilled by watching this movie. Again, like I said, like, not a lot happens in this movie, but it's fairly short. It's got a nice languid pace. Jodorowsky is wonderful in the lead role. It's fantastic music, a nice, fun, interesting way to spend, you know, an hour and a half.
All right, that's number one. What's up next?
Let's talk about Chick Fight, because I saw a movie called Chick Fight.
All right,
it's an indie comedy. It's directed by Paul Leyden, script by Joseph Downey, and it's basically we could dress it up, but it's basically about a female fight club. And the circumstances surrounding said club. It stars Malin Ackerman as a woman named Anna, who's dealing with a life that's crumbling around her a bit. She's behind on her bills, her business. She owns a coffee shop. Her business is floundering. Plus, her dad, Ed, played by a former WWE superstar Kevin Nash. Has come out as bisexual following the death of her mother. And so she's got, like, everything she thought she knew about the world is being called into question. She's lost, and she's got this feeling of powerlessness. The opportunity to change all that comes when her best friend, Charlene, played by Dulce Sloan, decides to introduce her to this whole new circle, specifically to the club. It's this warehouse that's been converted into a place where women could deal with their personal issues in the very primal and physical fashion of fighting one another. It's run by a woman named Bear, played by Fortune Femster. And the whole point is to help women deal with the pressures of their lives in very immediate and visceral ways, sort of removed from the expectations society places on them. It's all very strictly monitored. It's safe. There's a doctor on hand. It's actually Bear's brother, a guy named Roy, played by Kevin Connolly. But there's a contingent of new members, led by a vicious young lady named Olivia, played by Bella Thorne, that's less about the club and more about the fighting. Anna finds herself in the crosshairs of some of these brutal newcomers and is forced to prepare for a fight, but she's never been in a fight before. She needs a trainer, and through circumstances that I'm not going to go into here, she winds up being trained by a fella named Murphy, played by Alec Baldwin, who's a local legend who apparently worked with famous clients back in the day. But even as the rest of her life is crumbling, the club gives her some focus, some purpose, and when she learns the secret of the club's origins, it only becomes clearer that she has to keep fighting, even as the odds against her keep growing. I wanted to, like, this wasn't a bad movie. I don't mean to, and I'm certainly not saying that it is, but it's a movie that I wanted to like more than I did. It's one of those comedies that never quite clicks. There's some solid jokes and some sort of feints toward female empowerment. The pieces never fully fit together. It's funny. It's kind of ironic, but the biggest issue with the movie is the fact that it doesn't hit hard enough. Like, if it had leaned more heavily on the themes instead of kind of contenting itself with slapstick physicality and a few slow-mo fight scenes, there might have been more of a spark to it. My basic takeaway is, the filmmakers essentially just slapped a dress and a smile on Fight Club and kind of called it a day. some of it works. The fight scenes are pretty good. The training montages are fun. But it's not enough to really elevate the proceedings to match what I think is considerable potential with the film. And it's not the cast's fault. Malin Ackerman is lovely here. She has this real gift for exuding likability. So it's very difficult not to root for her, which makes her ideal for a movie like this. And she does her best to charm her way through the sort of tonal and thematic inconsistency, and comes closer than really she has any right to. The rest of the supporting cast is pretty solid. Dulce Sloan is kind of a chaos agent in the best way. nice to see Kevin Connolly around. I kind of thought he was, I didn't know if he'd retired or if he died, but it was nice to see him show up in something. Bella Thorne is someone who the jury's still out as far as how I feel about her, but the more I see her in stuff, the more I realize there might be more to her than I initially thought. Like, she might bring some more to the table than we would have expected. I'll be curious to see like how her projects play out in the years to come, because again, there's a real interesting energy to her. And Alec Baldwin is being Alec Baldwin. Like, granted, he's a drunk Alec Baldwin, but I mean, there's a fundamental Alec Baldwin-ness that never really goes away. But in this case, it kind of works. Look, it's not a terrible movie. It's frankly better than I initially expected it to be. It's just, it's a little unfocused, a little shaggy, and if they tightened it up, a little bit would have gone a long way. Like, it could have been a knockout, but ultimately what we get is a split decision.
All right. Well, let's move on to film number three.
We'll do a quick hit on this one, mostly because I sometimes worry that I allow my affiliation with sites like Rotten Tomatoes to unduly influence the way I feel about movies. And so I'm always, it's always sort of, nice is the wrong word, but it's like, every once in a while, I'll fundamentally disagree with the consensus, and I feel like that's good. I feel like that's a good thing. You never want to just be with, be in the same side of the crowd all the time. But it's rare that it's so striking. I saw a movie called The Nest. It's a domestic drama, family-driven, written and directed by Sean Durkin, and starring Jude Law and Carrie Coon. Like, all the pieces are there for this to be a really good movie. And most critics feel very strongly that it is, in fact, a really good movie. I disagree with them wholeheartedly, Rich. It's a movie that has substituted style and atmosphere for storytelling, it's basically those things are used instead of storytelling rather than enhancing the story. Like, it's got some brooding and foreboding vibes, but the truth is that not much actually happens. granted, you've got an exceptional pair of actors in the lead, and you know, an undeniably evocative aesthetic. There's some engagement to be found, but again, there's an absence. There's an emptiness at the middle of the film. It's like an empty package. It's interesting, but there's nothing inside. You've got a guy named Rory. He's an English commodities broker, and he's married to an American horse trainer named Allison. They have two kids, Samantha and Benjamin. They live in the United States, but an opportunity for Rory to return to his old firm comes up, and so they pull up stakes and move to London. Specifically, they wind up in a sort of rundown but still stately manor house, this massive estate for just four people. Rory goes back to his old firm under the leadership of his former boss and just promises the world to the family. Great schools for the kids, a new stable and training ring for his wife. So much stuff, and it just seems too good to be true. And as it turns out, it is, in fact, too good to be true. The cracks start to show. Rory's struggling at work. He's pushing for big, splashy moves despite resistance from higher-ups. The family finances are in shambles. Like, Allison takes to, like, actually hiding money so that Rory can't get his hands on it. Samantha, the daughter, is rebelling at her new school, and Benjamin, the son, is struggling at his. Rory is secret and erratic, and that leaves Allison angry and exasperated with this ominous energy that surrounds the house and the family, and it all starts to crumble. No one really seems to have any idea how to set things right again. My big issue with the movie is that it doesn't seem like it knows what it wants to be. Like, the first half hour reads as the first act of a horror movie, like spooky vibes and occasionally hints at something sinister. But then the actual scary stuff just doesn't happen. Like, I mean, we're talking like mysteriously open doors and spooky dark hallways, things that are mentioned or even seen on screen but are never referenced again. It's like the filmmaker like set out to deliberately avoid teasing out any of the threads that he lays out. Like, ideas and images are introduced and then just promptly forgotten or ignored, which leaves you with something that feels to me like a horror movie without any of the horror. And I don't mean to say there's nothing of merit here. The aesthetic, like I said, is really interesting. There's a very dark saturation of things that's very evocative, and there are some well executed, very squirmy moments of familial conflict that really kind of cook. Like, and the slow disintegration of the family is tough to watch in a good way. The performances, Jude Law and Carrie Coon are both incredibly talented, and that shows. But all those elements that are, while valuable, cannot overcome the simple fact that there's just nothing to the story. So you have a movie that's both short yet feels too leisurely paced. Which is, it's just tough to pull off in any rate. But, yeah, like, I find movies like this to be frustrating because there are quality pieces here, but they're kind of left to function mostly on their own without the central narrative that would kind of serve as the structure to hang them on. You know, strong performances and an interesting aesthetic are enough to keep it from falling completely flat, but ultimately, like, there's just not much here. You know, it's a nest that's mostly empty.
All right, and we got a couple of minutes left. Can we squeeze in one more?
Yeah, we could. We'll talk about this one real quick, just because I don't want to say too much about it anyway, because I think people should just see it. I tuned into Netflix to see Jingle Jangle, A Christmas Journey.
Mm.
Look, making a holiday movie is super easy. Like, they get churned out like by the dozens every year with a metronomic regularity. Just throw some snow and lights in there and you're pretty much there. But making a good one, that's more difficult. And it's nice to see a movie like Jingle Jangle, written and directed by David E. Talbert, bring this sort of welcome new energy to the holiday movie landscape. Like, it's a great story. The music is fantastic. The performances are good. Some outstanding production numbers. It's just this wonderful romp of a film. Like, the kind of movie that I think is probably going to wind up in many people's sort of regular rotation of seasonal offerings. Like, it's energetic, it's original, and it's just super fun. Like, it's packed with the kind of excitement that one expects from the best kind of Christmas movies. The plot, real quick, Jeronicus Jangle is a renowned inventor and toy maker. He owns a shop called Jangles and Things. He's famous for his creations, but his latest toy is going to be his greatest. It's a self-aware, autonomous matador doll named Don Juan Diego, voiced by Ricky Martin, which is hysterical. But as he seeks to celebrate, his apprentice, a young man named Gustafson, steals Diego and the plans for all of Django's inventions and strikes out on his own. The loss devastates Jeronicus, and followed almost immediately by the passing of his wife, he falls apart and sends his daughter away while he descends into ruin. Now, years later, we get a much older Jeronicus Jangle, played now by Forrest Whitaker, who's fantastic in this movie. He's living in the rundown remains of the store, which has become a pawn shop. He's bitter and lonely, and just trying to get by. His now grown daughter sends her own daughter named Journey, played by a young lady in her debut named Madeline Mills, to visit Jangle for the holiday. And he struggles to figure out how to deal with her. Complicating matters is the now grown Gustafson, played now by Keegan-Michael Key, who's also awesome, who has built a toy-making empire using Jangle's plans. But he's reached the end of what he stole and needs to figure out if there's anything else he can get. As you might guess, there's a great invention still at Jangles and Things, gathering dust in the attic, needs someone to figure out how it works. I'll leave you to determine who might actually be able to wind up doing that. But yeah, look, man, this movie is a delight. It's the story sweet. The choreography is fantastic. The original songs are just bangers. It's also a wonderfully deep film in terms of representation, in terms of black and other cultural representation. The sort of movie that that culturally, I think we're long overdue to get this kind of movie. It's just bustling and busy, like this brightly colored Christmas candy of a movie with a couple of big song and dance numbers and some wonderful songs, including one sung by Forrest Whitaker, I didn't know he could sing, but he's great. Again, on and on. It's the sort of movie that's a lot of fun, and also, I think, bears a degree of importance with regards to the steps towards wider representation that it takes. Just across the board successful.
Awesome.
I really think it's going to develop a following going forward.
I can't wait to see it. 4 from Alan Adams this week. A full house of fun. Alan, we thank you as always, and well, let's talk again on Wednesday.
Yeah, we'll talk to you soon, man.
All right. Thanks, Alan.